This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
This past Sunday, two German states held elections, and the results were devastating for Germany's mainstream political parties. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, these elections are particularly important because this kind of kicks off a super election year, as it's being called in Germany. You have the federal elections coming up on September 26th. Angela Merkel is stepping down, and so Germany will be having a new chancellor in just a few months' time. In the run-up to that, there are now four more state elections, and this determines state governments. It determines who goes into Germany's Senate. So that's a total of six different state elections, including these ones. So critical election year. It's going to be very decisive for who controls Germany going forwards. And these were the two elections that kick it all off. So these were the ones that everyone was kind of looking at to set the tone for what's going to be a critical few months for German politics. And what set the tone is being what Germany's Tagesschau called it, a fatal signal from the Christian Democratic Union. That's Angela Merkel's party. They had some record bad results, really, various different records in both states. So in the state of Rhineland-Palatinate, they only won 27.7% of the vote. That was down 4%. Baden-Württemberg, it was 24% of the vote. That in particular was its worst ever result for the state. It could find itself absent from the ruling coalition of that state for the first time in, I think, something like 58 years. These are, at best, mediocre results in what is typically the CDU's heartland. And so it's looking very bad for them. And the big beneficiaries this time, you know, within Germany, we've talked about the rise of the fringe and the AfD. That wasn't particularly the case in these election results. Instead, Germany's main left-wing party, the SDP, SPD, they're down from, say, how they were doing maybe 10 years ago, but there weren't terrible results for them. And the Green Party, a much more further left party, has been picking up a lot of those votes and been doing very well in those states.
So we have seen this trend developing over a period of some years, this move away from these parties that have really dominated German politics for generations. We've talked about this more related to the migrant crisis and more political and economic crises. This is those problems have been compounded by the coronavirus and what has been happening this past year in Germany, correct?
That's right. This is probably the big change in terms of what's been happening here over the last few months. I mean, if we go back even 3-4 months ago, Angela Merkel was actually doing very well in the polls. Now, she wouldn't be running, but it still helped the CDU that her personal approval rating was very high. The polls showed people didn't much like her successors, but they liked her. And you could kind of see why. You just look at the statistics for how Germany had dealt with the coronavirus. They had fewer people dying per unit of population, per 100,000. And they could put forward this narrative of, okay, maybe Angela Merkel's not the most exciting leader, but she's quietly competent. She has dealt well with this crisis, and we're in a much better position than other countries. And that kind of gels with her personality, and that was a great narrative for her. What we've seen over the last 3 or 4 months is a shambolic vaccine rollout within Europe. And you know, just in the question of vaccine more generally, we had a great article this week on our website from Mr. Stephen Flurry on the subject of the vaccine. I want to kind of just talk about the political impacts of this in Europe, because now you're having this situation set in where Britain and America and Israel have been vaccinating at a massive pace while Europe is, it's been a mess. And this is impacting very personally on Angela Merkel. This is the kind of thing that she is meant to be good at, the quiet, competent detail stuff. Instead, she delegated, and it was her personal intervention that delegated a lot of this to the European Union. The subject of vaccines in the European Union, even regardless of the German election, they've been absolutely dominating the headlines in Britain and Europe this week, where you've had this big spat where, on the one hand, Europe has been saying, we want more Oxford AstraZeneca vaccines. Give us more Oxford AstraZeneca vaccines. If you don't, we're going to go all Stalin on you, and we're going to seize the factories that make them, and we will block exports. We're going to have the police raiding companies, and we're going to grab these vaccines. At the same time, they've also been saying, we don't want your stupid vaccines anyway. They cause blood clots. We're not going to give them out. So they've been pushing both extremes there. And so in Germany, the perception very much is a mess, and a mess that Angela Merkel is in part responsible for delegating the vaccines to Europe instead of taking care of it in-house. On top of that, you've had the biggest scandal for the Christian Democratic and Christian Social Union parties, again, all to do with coronavirus, where there have been accusations that they have been involved in corrupt deals over the sale of protective equipment, you know, that they've been getting kickbacks for pushing government contracts in the direction of certain firms. So it used to be the Angela Merkel successors were unpopular, but at least her brand and the party's brand were still rising high. That's changed in the last few weeks. Her brand, the party's brand, are very much tarnished. And that has thrown this whole election year wide open. There's even talk of potentially the next German chancellor coming from the Green Party. There's talk of a traffic light coalition emerging at the end of this year, which would be the Reds, the Social Democrats, the Greens, and then the Orange, the supposedly pro-business FDP. And this puts an interesting situation in Germany, because both the SDP and the Greens, they don't have a leader. They have two leaders. That's the kind of the new thing to do for left-wing parties, to avoid, I don't know, this patriarchal model of having a single person in charge. I don't think it's clear for either of those parties exactly then, if they win, how you choose a chancellor. So you've got a lot of political uncertainty in Germany as a result of this. I mean, it's the party that has ruled Germany for 16 years and is almost the default ruling party of Germany is going through a bit of a crisis right now. So that puts a lot of uncertainty on this election year.
Well, when you look over the last, several years in Germany, it seems like there's been the potential for, there have been quite a few political crises. And in a way, Angela Merkel has been the only constant among all of this, that you've seen some pretty serious political earthquakes because of election results. Along the lines of what you're describing here, there was a long time when there was no governing coalition, and you take Angela Merkel out of the picture, and what you're left with is quite a parched landscape.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I mean, you've got people that basically since they've been a child, Angela Merkel's been the ruler of Germany.
Yeah,
they don't really have a memory of anybody else in charge. It's been a long time that she's been in there. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right. She's the one that's been holding this together. There's a lot of uncertainty as to what happens when she goes, and that deadline is getting closer and closer. I mean, her party haven't even decided who's going to run to replace her yet. You know, there's a couple of candidates. They just elected a new leader. He's been tarnished in some of the latest scandals. So it's odd. I mean, you would never have this situation in America, where a presidential election is 6 months out and you don't know who the candidate is yet. It seems like the American politicking goes on almost constantly. As soon as
right.
one presidential
yeah,
election
absolutely.
Ends, the next cycle begins.
Yeah.
But a whole lot of uncertainty for Germany.
We at the Trumpet watch German politics very closely because of specific Bible prophecies. We've talked about the the dangers posed by this kind of political instability in Germany quite a lot. Explain that to our listeners.
Yeah, we have a lot of long-standing, big-scale forecasts, and so many of them, I think, are already here. You know, you can see Russia and China, events that Herbert W. Armstrong said would come on the scene. It hasn't been there for, it wasn't there for a long time. It's been there for quite a while now. You see Iran kind of really coming to the fore as the leader in the Middle East, just like we've said it would. One of the biggest prophecies that we've been forecasting for a long time that you don't see yet is a strong German leader. And so much of what the Bible talks about in terms of end time events relate to this prophecy of a strong leader. So this is something that we're watching for, but the Bible tells us a lot about how he comes to power. It talks, for example, in Daniel chapter 8 about him coming to power by flatteries, and about coming in some kind of, you know, you look into what the Hebrew word translated flatteries there means, and it's, you know, it's some kind of irregular, unorthodox route, as opposed to through a standard political succession. It kind of points to some kind of political crisis within Europe or within Germany. There are other prophecies that talk about a radical change that's coming to German government. It's going to be led by kings. It's going to be led, it's going to become a lot more authoritarian. So this is what we're watching for, and some kind of political crisis, political paralysis, that would really pave the way for someone to come in an unorthodox fashion and to not be bound by the typical checks and balances and democracy that you would normally expect a leader to be bound by, but instead to rule in a much more autocratic fashion. You know, somebody like that is somebody who's going to come in probably through a through some kind of crisis. That's what you see building to in Germany. And sorry, I said Daniel 8. It's Daniel chapter 11, verse 21, that talks about him coming in by flattery. So we have a lot of specific prophecies about how he comes into power. We don't see him yet, but we see the conditions described by the Bible on the scene right now. So this is something that could come into place very quickly. And when that happens, you have so much of what the Bible talks about in terms of end time events lined up, ready to move forwards, and we can move very quickly. And there's some bad news in that moving quickly, but it also means that we're moving quickly towards the very wonderful conclusion of all of these events talked about in the Bible. And we have a booklet that talks about, that describes these in much more detail. A strong German leader is imminent, that will take you through exactly what these prophecies are, why it is that Daniel 11 refers to Germany. And of course, this booklet and all of our material is free.
And on top of that, we have the article that was distributed on our Trumpet Brief email list on Tuesday by Josue Michels about these election results in particular. Division, infighting, and election disasters are tearing Germany apart. You can check that out at thetrumpet.com. We'll link to that and the booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, in the show notes for today's program. Go check those out. Thank you very much, Richard. Speaking of vaccine rollouts, President Joe Biden is boasting about the job that his administration has done and a milestone that they will reach this coming week. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, actually, they passed a big milestone on their vaccination plan today. As of today or sometime today, it's projected that the Biden administration will have passed 100 million coronavirus vaccination injections. So that's about 30% of Americans. And I guess
would that include two vaccine jabs for some people?
Well, that is a good point. I guess it's 100 million injections, so that might be less than
Fewer than a third of the population.
Less than a third of the population, if people have gotten multiple injections, but enough that they seem to be getting closer to critical mass for the type of people who want the injections, because they're starting. So far, they've been keeping them in the United States, but they're starting to get ready to ship some of these vaccines to Mexico and Canada. They're getting ready to ship about 2.5 million vaccine injections to Mexico and 1.5 million to Canada. So definitely going fast and furious with these injections. It was just not long ago that Joe Biden had given a speech talking about how he's calling in FEMA disaster personnel and retired doctors and nurses, active duty military personnel, all to help with the rollout of these vaccinations. So not just the regular doctors, but like all hands on deck, even getting like a military operation involved in some ways to get as many people vaccinated as possible. But as we pointed out on the website this week, our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, had an article entitled "The Truth About the Vaccination," just pointing out that the Biden administration's done this all. I mean, they've only been in office 58 days, so I mean, this is definitely a rushed job, but definitely has not done due diligence in looking at what are the side effects or the unintended consequences of these vaccinations. I mean, just as fast as it's pushed out, you haven't really had much chance to examine these vaccines. Some nations are still banning them. Richard mentioned earlier that the AstraZeneca one has been associated with blood clots that could be very dangerous to human health. And then they had one interview that hasn't gotten any content on YouTube, but you can find it online, about the Moderna booster that where Ben Stein, the writer and actor Ben Stein, he came out and talked about the Moderna booster, where he said, "I had the COVID booster by Moderna 4 or 5 days ago, and I'm still reeling from the wild side effects. It's like I had the worst flu in the world. Extreme shortness of breath, dizziness, fatigue, extreme irrational thinking. It has just been devastating. This booster is a killer. It's not literally going to kill you, but it's very, very strong." So that's, that's definitely looks like a case of the cause being worse than the cure.
So 100 million jabs, and also they're boasting about 100 million stimulus checks.
Right, yeah. So your 100 million stimulus checks with the, you're about $1,400 per person.
Right.
So it's, which is COVID, like, supposed to be combating the effects of these lockdowns, the lockdowns you've had for COVID. So, which is going to, when you combine it with the other ones, it's going to increase the national debt by trillions of dollars. I think this is the fifth or sixth COVID relief package. And all said and done, it's pretty close to about $5 trillion in relief they've had here. So you've really got like this two-fisted punch the Biden administration's done to combat coronavirus. One, to like lock down to combat the effects of the economic lockdowns, you've increased your national debt by $5 trillion. Well, meanwhile, you're injecting millions of Americans with a vaccine that causes blood clots and extreme irrational thinking and liver failures and all sorts of other things. So it's, just disastrous, just some disastrous policies on both the economic, social, and human health front.
Well, if you'd like to read more about this, Stephen Fleury's article, "Truth About the Vaccine," is available at thetrumpet.com. He's also been covering it quite extensively on his program, The Trumpet Daily, that is available every morning at 7 a.m. on kpcg.fm. And I really encourage you to give that a listen. You can also see that at thetrumpet.com/live every day. So thank you very much for that, Andrew. The Biden administration has also been busy on the foreign policy front. It is rolling back several Trump administration positions regarding the Middle East peace process and resetting its relations with the Palestinians. For this story, we'll turn to Brenton Octagall.
There was a four-page U.S. memo that kind of showed what Biden's policy would be, at least initially, in terms of the Palestinian-Israeli peace process. And this was leaked in some fashion to The National. A U.S.-based reporter, Joyce Karam, she wrote this article based on that. So this is a draft of the declaration, a four-page declaration, or a four-page policy paper, I guess, of what they're going to try and change. It's called the U.S.-Palestinian Reset and the Path Forward. This was a document that was drafted by the Deputy Assistant Secretary for of state for Israeli-Palestinian affairs, Hedi Amir. We'll get to who he is in a second. But a couple of the big takeaways from what Biden's foreign policy in this area looks like it's going to be is similar to Obama's, a return to two-state solution based on the 1967 lines, meaning that there will be two states, but the West Bank will go to the Palestinian state and so on, with some land swaps. And then, again, we're going to be talking about security interests and the refugee issue, meaning, again, refugees from the 1948 war somehow returning back to Palestinian land, of which there's like 6 million of them now because of it's been so long and they've got extra generations of refugees. So it, on the face of it, the policy paper does not look too different from, let's say, Oslo, normal peace process, two-state solution, Israel stop building inside the West Bank, that's going to be Palestinian land. And that's something that the Trump administration totally rejected, saying that Israeli construction, the West Bank, is not in breaking international law. That was Trump's policy. He allowed it. He allowed the U.S. to engage in joint funding of scientific projects inside the West Bank, which was big because it showed that the U.S. funded Israeli work inside the West Bank as well. And all that is going to be rejected by the Biden administration. This paper also calls for reestablishing diplomatic ties with the Palestinian Authority. This is something that the Trump cut off based on the fact that the Palestinian Authority continued to pay terrorists that are sitting inside Israeli prisons right now. The pay for slay program, which means you commit a terrorist act, you kill Israelis, you go to Israeli prison, you get funded then, your family does, by the Palestinian Authority government. And Trump thought that it wasn't right that U.S. taxpayers are paying for the families of terrorists to have a good living. So he rejected that, as did the Senate, as did the Congress with the Taylor Force Act. It's against the law to do that now. So they're not funding the Palestinian Authority just yet, but that is the next thing that they're going to set up. The paper also looks ahead to the Palestinian elections that are due to take place on May 22nd. So they're coming up real soon. These would be the first Palestinian elections to take place in about 15 years. And what's interesting about this is they are really trying to ensure that East Jerusalem, Palestinians in East Jerusalem, get to vote in these elections. Typically, they don't because it's seen as area controlled by Israel. And so Israel doesn't allow them. And those East Jerusalemites, some of them want to belong to Israel and the others are pretty pro-Hamas. So it looks like a return to typical, let's say, peace process dealings, which have not amounted to anything at all over decades. However, there is a really interesting side point to this, and that is the author of this paper, Hedi Amir is his name. And this individual has, for the past, let's say, since 2006, he's worked for the Brookings Institution. This is a Washington-based think tank that's heavily funded by the Qatari government. Back in 2006, Qatar actually opened a Doha branch of the Brookings Institution, and he was the director general of the Doha branch for 10 years. And the New York Times had a piece last year that showed how the Qatar was funding Brookings and how lawyers suggested that they should be declaring themselves, these people that work for Brookings, as foreign agents. They need to be registered as foreign agents because of the funding that they get from the Qatari government. Now, why this is important is because Qatar is also the chief funder of the Muslim Brotherhood, chief funder of Hamas. Next year, they're going to be sending $370 million to Hamas inside the Gaza Strip to fund the Hamas government there.
Wow.
And so what you have here is the man that's drafting the United States policy for Israeli-Palestinian peace is an advocate of Hamas that has been on the Qatari payroll in the past and who's seeking Hamas to get more power. And through this paper, you can see that he wants this to happen in terms of the Palestinian elections coming up, which Hamas is desperate to be a part of. Hamas usually says they don't want to be a part of the Palestinian elections, but they do this year, and they've just elected two women to as part of their Politburo, some of the chief roles, to try and moderate their public image. And this man, Amir, who is heading up again the foreign policy for the Biden administration, he has tried in the past to moderate Hamas's, or at least make the public face of Hamas to be look more moderate. He has really written in papers expressing the desire and the need to reach out to Muslim Brotherhood groups and Hamas to be part of this political process with Israel. And so he's the one drafting this, and it's hard to see how it's any time. I'm just thinking about Israel's, as they're looking at this drafted paper by a pro-Hamas Muslim Brotherhood advocate for the Biden administration, how they're going to respond to this. All this is going to be lost on the general public. However, with these elections coming up very soon, in 2 months' time, and right now opinion polls put Hamas at winning 40% of the vote inside the West Bank. Right now they just control the Gaza Strip. However, there were similar opinion polls that came out in 2006 when Hamas surprised Fatah and won the parliamentary elections back then as well. So as we push towards those elections, we have a paper coming out written by a pro-Hamas advocate that is going to push Hamas to be part of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, if you can imagine that.
It's pretty stunning stuff, and you put this together with what the Biden administration has been doing with the Iran deal, and just how pro-Iran their policies have been. Here you have this openly supportive Hamas booster in the mix with the Biden administration. This puts Israel in a tough spot. You know, what had been their closest ally in dealing with these kinds of threats has now turned pretty hard in the opposite direction. What is it? Where does Israel go from here?
Well, it is hard for Israel, I think, to going forward to accept the United States as an honest broker for Middle East peace in terms of Israelis and Palestinians now, considering the history of the man that's leading this charge for the Biden administration. What I believe the Biden administration is doing through this is that they are going to try and moderate, or at least in the public image, moderate Hamas, the terrorist organization getting its funding from Qatar and Iran. And that is going to push Israel to... Israel cannot deal with Hamas as a representative of the Palestinian people because Hamas is sworn to their destruction. That is the fact. They might change their face a little bit to try and gain public acceptance. And so Israel, I think, is going to come to the point where they are going to be seen as the ones that are rejecting peace. That is what the Obama Biden administration is going to be pushing, the narrative. Hey, we've got a peace process lined up. Yes, Hamas is there, but they're representative of the Palestinian people. Democracy rules, right? Israel, why aren't you negotiating with a democratically elected government? And Israel will just have to say at that point, sorry, we can't. They're sworn to our destruction. And then Israel will be looked at the problem. And we've expected, based on biblical prophecy, Israel to reject, or at least the United States to no longer be the chief mediating party between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and that Israel would look to Europe to fulfill that role, to become even more of an honest broker. And this prophecy is fully expounded in our editor, Mr. Gerald Flory's book, The Jerusalem and Prophecy. And those prophecies show that Israel is going to turn towards Germany to be more of that honest broker. And here it seems like the Americans are just taking themselves right out of the picture here, swinging from a pro-Israel position, as it would have been seen underneath the Trump administration, to a very pro, not just pro-Palestinian now, but pro-Hamas position for the Biden administration.
Stunning stuff. Where would you send people who want more information on this, Brent?
I think the Jerusalem Prophecy book will definitely give them the fundamentals and the prophecy here of what's going to come forward from this.
Thank you, Brent. Repression in Russia under President Vladimir Putin is growing more overt and brutal. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, there's a sad saga that we've really been following closely over the last few months because it reveals quite a lot about Vladimir Putin. And this centers on a man named Alexei Navalny. He is Putin's number one domestic opponent. And over the last decade, Putin has had him arrested numerous times. But in the last few months, something has really changed with Putin's approach to Navalny and Navalny's supporters. So this change was first evident back in August when Navalny was poisoned by a weapons-grade toxin. You know, that poisoning had Putin's fingerprints all over it because it's a substance that only someone in the upper echelons of the Russian government would be able to have access to. So it was an assassination attempt. But Navalny survived it. And then after about 5 months of treatment in Germany, he very boldly, I think, returned to Russia. That was in January. And Putin had him immediately arrested and sentenced to almost 3 years in Russia's terrible penal colony system. There was actually a number of weeks after that sentencing when Navalny's whereabouts were unknown. Some even speculated that he had secretly been assassinated. But this week, Navalny managed to meet with his lawyers in prison. And they released a statement from him saying that he just where he is and sort of discussing some of the circumstances he's facing. In one part of his message, Navalny says, "I had no idea that it was possible to arrange a real concentration camp 100 kilometers from Moscow." And then he details some of the horrors that he faces there, and he talks about how the whole thing feels like a chapter out of 1984, George Orwell's famous dystopian novel. So this was a major move by Putin. It sends a clear message to any who oppose him, because up until now, when it came to domestic threats against him, Putin was iron-fisted and he was brutal, but he generally tried to keep his brutality in the shadows. But now that has changed. Russian journalist Andrei Kolesnikov discussed this week, and he said, "Putin was always brutal, but now he has decided to be brutal freely, openly, and without restrictions." So it's a new approach for Putin, and it actually goes well beyond just Navalny. His arrest and his sentencing prompted a series of protests by his supporters, and Putin's officers have responded to those with unprecedented force. There's quite a lot of video footage showing riot police just beating protesters with truncheons, an overwhelming number of reports about violence and torture and all kinds of inhumane treatment of these detainees. For a lot of the protesters who evaded initial arrest, Putin also used a whole network of facial recognition cameras that were supposedly set up to help authorities enforce coronavirus restrictions.
Very
to later go find them and to arrest all of them. So it is unprecedented. It truly is Orwellian. And it shows that Putin has entered a new era. You know, one of the other salient quotes from Kolesnikov says, "We see more brutality and more aggression toward Putin's opponents, and it works. The red line is in the past. We have already experienced the moment where Putin crossed the line into an autocratic state."
Yeah, this type of autocracy and repression taking place in Russia has pretty chilling historical echoes.
It really does, yes. If you look at Russian history, there's actually a pattern that emerges with kind of a four-phase cycle. First comes national calamity, whether that's from some kind of foreign invasion or just poor internal planning. Second, from out of the rubble, emerges an idealistic leader. You could call this the White Rider. And this White Rider figure brings, you know, kind of a level of stability. We've seen this with Peter the Great, Catherine the Great. Some historians even place Vladimir Lenin in this category. But then in the third phase, after this White Rider figure succumbs to political frustration or he's otherwise defeated, he's followed by a Dark Rider. And this is a very different kind of ruler. Men like Ivan the Terrible and the Velikis and most recently Joseph Stalin. So Russia has had far too many of these, and under them, the country descends into terrible times. The Dark Rider ruthlessly quashes domestic opposition. He often expands Russia's borders until the overextended empire just kind of slumps into the fourth phase, which is stagnation and decline, and then finally collapse back into that first phase of national calamity once again. And so the cycle goes. So we've seen that play out many times over the centuries. And if we look at where Russia is right now, we know that in the 90s, it suffered major national calamity with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And then Putin emerged as this heroic white rider. And during his first decade, his economic victories really did lift millions from poverty and brought a lot of stability that was sorely absent during the 90s. But now we see that Russia's white rider phase has ended. Since 2014, real incomes have plummeted. GDP per person is 30% lower, and the number below the poverty line has grown by about 20%. So, you know, the terrible times are back. And when you look at that, alongside this unprecedented crackdown on Navalny and his supporters, you see that something very interesting has happened, and that is that the white rider has actually become the dark rider. And this wasn't totally unexpected. Back in 2007, the Stratfor Intelligence team was writing about this Russian cycle, and they wrote, quote, "In particularly gloomy periods in Russia's past, the white rider himself actually has shed his idealism and become the dark rider." And then they speculated a little bit then that that this could happen with Putin. And I think if we look at the situation in Russia now, the rising poverty and the ruthless crackdown on dissent and Putin's new laws that also will let him stay in power for life, I think we can see that that has happened. Putin is now Russia's dark rider, and that's a very sobering development.
It seems like there are few places on Earth that have experienced the kind of suffering under this kind of leadership that Russia has. Jeremiah has written an article that is up at thetrumpet.com, Vladimir Putin Becomes Russia's Dark Rider. You can check that out. And he also links to other material in that article that show the prophetic implications of what is happening there today. We thank you for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, some wild stories, including a K-12 curriculum proposal in California that would have children chanting to Aztec deities, and a Canadian man being thrown in jail for failing to refer to his own transgender daughter by her preferred pronouns. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Canada is very serious about ensuring that you refer to transgenders by their preferred pronouns, even if it's your own daughter. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is one of the craziest stories of the week, where there's a Canada man, Robert Hoogland from British Columbia, who was actually jailed for referring to his own biological female child as his daughter. His daughter is 14 years old. Identifies as transgenders and prefers male pronouns. She's looking to get gender reassignment surgery. The mother supports it, the father doesn't. So some family strife there. But I guess she filed a restraining order against her own father on charges of referring to her as a girl, calling her by her birth name, and attempting to dissuade her from getting gender reassignment surgery. And that's what got them, that restraining order, what got the father in court. And during the court proceedings, he insisted on keeping calling his daughter as his daughter and her birth name. And which prompted the judge to hold him in contempt of court. And he was actually arrested for this on March 4th.
So contempt of court is what they actually threw him in jail for, but it was contempt based on his refusal to
contempt based
hold
on his
to reality.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
All right, nutty stuff. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll leave that where it is. Thank you for that, Andrew. We'll move back to the Middle East now. Iran's nuclear weapons program is rapidly advancing. To learn about the latest, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, there was another report that came out by the International Atomic Energy Agency on March 15th that Iran has started to enrich uranium at its Natanz nuclear facility using a more highly advanced centrifuge. These are the technological devices that enrich uranium to a greater purity so that it can be eventually used in a nuclear weapon. And the IR-4 is the most advanced to be used by the Iranians, and they have one cascade going right now, spinning as we speak, to enrich uranium up to 5% there. This is, of course, breaking the nuclear agreement, the JCPOA, that was coming to existence back in 2015 and 16. It adds another layer of Iran's refusal to comply with that. It adds another layer of Iran increasing its leverage in many ways over the Biden administration. The Biden administration is trying to get Iran to come back towards compliance. Iran says, we're not going to do that until you give us $1 trillion or close to it. And so before the Biden administration does that, Iran keeps on employing more advanced centrifuges, keeps on increasing the amount of highly enriched uranium that it has. It has a number of facilities doing this. The one in Natanz, I think it gets it to 5%. The one at Fordow that's going right now, another site, some of that's up to 20%, which sounds like a long way to get from 5 to 20 to 100, which is, or 90, which is needed for a nuclear weapon. However, once you get to 20%, it's only another 5% in terms of the whole process to get to 90%. So we're actually quite far along, Iran is right now, from getting the amount of uranium that's necessary for a nuclear weapon. It is not being contained or constrained by the Biden administration. The Europeans themselves actually wanted to come out and put some harder enforcement or increase the pressure on Iran to stop. But the Biden administration reached out to the Europeans and said, don't do that. It's going to derail our negotiations for Iran to come back into compliance for the deal. And so we're 3 months in now, and Iran says it wants a deal. Biden says he wants a deal. And yet Iran is racing the way towards a nuclear weapon.
Iran is deadly serious about reaching a nuclear bomb. And it seems like the world is just not accepting this reality.
Well, I think it's gone on for so many years, the Iran nuclear program, as a source of negotiations, and it hasn't happened yet. They don't have a bomb, as we know, right, as we are aware of, at least right now. And so the people in the world are quite deaf to this. And you have an American administration that really does believe that they can bring, or at least they're telling the mainstream media that they can bring Iran back into compliance with this deal, which the deal itself didn't stop, again, Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. It just delayed it by a decade. However, the terrifying reality of this is that Iran is using this time right now, while it's apparently suffering economically, to push towards a bomb. The reality is it is enriching uranium to a higher degree, to a greater purity. It is getting closer to a nuclear weapon. Estimates are right now 2 to 3 months. That's not very far. That's pretty scary if it's 2 to 3 months away from the chief state sponsor of terrorism getting a nuclear weapon. Now, people will ask, will Iran really use a nuclear weapon if it gets it? No one else has used one, so why should they be any different? And this is really a dangerous way to look at the Iranian regime. They are different. They, as Mr. Fleury has written in his book, The King of the South, they do not uphold to the normal nuclear calculus of mutually assured destruction.
Right.
They are a fanatical regime that believes that world chaos can be brought up, will bring upon the return of their messiah. And so they don't have to win that war, they just have to start it. And so as Iran gets towards a nuclear bomb, people should be worried at that reality and just put aside all the facade of nuclear deal and no nuclear deal. The reality is Iran is marching towards that bomb.
Well, we have an article that will appear soon at thetrumpet.com, Iran using advanced centrifuge underground, and you can look for that. We thank you, Brent. How did COVID-19 start A group of scientists recently traveled to Wuhan, China, in search of an answer. So to learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the World Health Organization has been carrying out a big investigation in China to get to the bottom of the COVID-19 outbreak, mostly just to ascertain how it broke out and how it spread so quickly. And this has been highly anticipated. Many have been very hopeful that the findings would just be instrumental in learning how to prevent future outbreaks. But this week, the Wall Street Journal published, I think, just a bombshell report saying we should not expect much to come out of this at all for one simple reason, and that's because the Chinese government resisted, interfered, and intervened in all kinds of different ways just to prevent much of anything from really being discovered. So this is quite a long read, this Wall Street Journal article. It's about 5,000 words long and just very thoroughly documents all the different tactics that China used to hamper this investigation. Talks about China's refusal to share critical data on the earliest confirmed cases. It talks about how the Chinese cherry-picked which investigators from other countries would even be allowed to come in. All the ones that Washington put forth were not allowed to. They ended up selecting a few other Americans, presumably those who were somehow beholden to China or at least soft on it. So this report's findings, you know, they've been highly anticipated for a long time. They're supposed to be published next week. But because of China's interference, we shouldn't expect them to reveal anything of real substance.
This is the kind of information that continually comes out of China. And what I find so interesting is how much European nations in particular, and of course we could talk about the Biden administration as well, just give China a pass despite this.
That's a very interesting part of this whole fiasco. And the Wall Street Journal actually calls attention to that part of it. In one part, they're talking about the way China blocks so many scientists, especially those from America, from joining the investigation. And they write, "None of the experts Washington recommended received a call. And U.S. allies were concerned about what appeared to be an opaque selection process. But the U.S. struggled to get them to say so publicly or to pressure the WHO. And then it says, European allies, particularly Germany, were worried about antagonizing China, a trading partner vital to their economic recovery." Mm-hmm. End quote. So that just shows you what the priorities of the Europeans and especially the Germans really are. And I think that's just shameful.
Well, the relationship between Germany and China is prophesied.
It is, yes. And that's a prophecy that we talk about often. Isaiah 23 discusses a multinational trade bloc that will be formed in the modern day. And it shows that two of the main powers in that bloc will be China and Europe, a Europe that's led by Germany. So this is just remarkable to see that written about in ancient scriptures, and then to see China and Germany today forging this deep trade bond right now. And the scriptures make clear that this trade partnership will go from kind of ignoring and slighting America, which we already see happening, to directly besieging it. So this trade partnership will operate to the extreme detriment, really, of America and some of its allies.
All right. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. We spoke at the beginning of the program about troubling election results in Germany. We'll look briefly now at a related story playing out in the Netherlands. For this, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, the Netherlands had their main election, their big election this week. The main headline is that it looks like the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte is on course for a fourth term in office. He could well become the Netherlands' longest ever serving head of government. His party did very well. Just like a lot of other European countries, though, the politics revolves around different coalitions and things like that. So there's still going to be coalition negotiations. There's still room for some kind of an upset. But he won 35 out of 150 seats, improving his number of seats by two based on the previous election. And it looks like he is pretty much a shoo-in now to be the prime minister. But what I wanted to focus on is this was also a good result for the fringe parties, for the extreme parties in the Netherlands. The extreme party that's there, in some ways, they've been a victim of their own success. They've done so well that they've kind of fractured now into several different groups that people can choose from. This makes them, I think, less powerful than they could be if they were united. But still, the fact that so many people voted for these fringe parties is remarkable. They combined, they had their best result in recent history with 29 seats. Gerhard Wilders' PVV party, they had 17 seats. Thierry Baudet's Forum for Democracy, they quadrupled their seats to 8. There's a new party, JA21, and they look like they're going to enter parliament with 4 seats. But this rise of some of these fringe parties, it is a symptom. It's the symptom of the type of political crisis that we were talking about within Germany. I mean, some of these parties are extreme. Some, you know, I quite like a lot of what Geert Wilders has done and some of the productions that he's put out. But they're outside the mainstream of European politics. These are often leaders that are pretty passionately against Islam, for example. And so for people to be reaching for these parties in increasingly large numbers is yet another symptom of this political unrest that we're seeing building, not just in Germany, but all across Europe. And we talked about the changes that the Bible prophesies for Germany in the first half, but really it prophesies changes for all of Europe. Revelation chapter 17 talks about this power that's led by Germany being made up of 10 kings. It's a combined power that, you know, other European powers are a part of. It's not just a German element. And it talks about, you know, 10 kings, not 10 Democrats, 10 presidents. So there's the Bible very clearly forecasts autocratic leadership, not just for Germany, but all across Europe. And once again, that's a big change for Europe, something that requires a crisis. And so I point people again to that strong German leadership, a strong German leader is imminent booklet that we have. And we're seeing this trend reflected in other European countries, too.
Yeah, we also have a trend article, The Rise of a German Strongman, that you can check out, and we'll link to in the show notes. Thank you for that, Richard. We're going to finish the program today with a look at this proposed K-12 curriculum in California that would have children openly practicing demonic paganism. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, if you thought the story about the Canadian man getting arrested for calling his daughter a girl was the craziest story of the week, it's got competition. Because yesterday, the California's Department of Education approved some new ethics studies curriculum. Now, it's still pending the signing by the governor before it goes into an action statewide. But as you kind of almost have come to expect from radical leftist ethics studies curriculum, it accuses the United States of being a racist, patriarchal, misogynistic, sexist, genocidal society. And it accuses the European settlers who came here of murdering the native gods in order to replace them with their Christian god. But their solution... Their solution to this supposed problem is quite unique. Well, they're saying you need like a countercultural pushback against this, and so to push back against this this racist, misogynistic, genocidal Christian God, as they phrase it, they're actually encouraging students to chant to Aztec deities. I actually saw a video of some high school students doing this where it's really energetic with like clapping and chanting, and I didn't understand the language, but it was a prayer to the Aztec deity Tezcatlipoca. Hopefully that's the right pronunciation, but that deity is the Aztec deity of night and sorcery, and was one of the deities that were amongst many who were worshipped with both cannibalism and human sacrifice. And this incantation they're making to Tezcatlipoca is asking them for the power to become warriors for social justice. So they're actually praying to this this demonic sorcery god for powers to become social justice against Christianity. And then, like, of course, the great irony is they're saying, well, we're doing this because Christianity is so patriarchal and so genocidal. It's like, well, this is a deity that was literally worshipped by ripping the heart out of still living people. I think the archaeology estimates probably about 25,000 people a year sacrificed while still living to these various Aztec deities. So, I mean, this is... Like I said, if you want to criticize a genocidal society. This is what one looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Regime in Mexico that was toppled when the Europeans came over here. So I mean, it's just really crazy how far the left has gone. I mean, you've got the strange contradictions in the radical left, where you've got feminists and transgenders and Islamists and Wiccans and atheists and socialists and Wall Street CEOs all like voting together, even though they have nothing in common, out of like a mutual hatred of Judeo-Christian values. And this is probably one of the staunchest examples of just how far they're willing to go to topple those values, even if it means praying to this demonic sorcery god.
Mm. Well, that gets my vote for the craziest story of the week. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Walter Elliott. Perseverance is not a long race. It is many short races, one after another. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.